So now we're at the third day of our 7-day retreat, and the topic is the third faculty, which is mindfulness. And mindfulness, you know, is the heart of this practice that we're doing. We practice mindfulness, we say, often. And I would like to offer a story that speaks to an aspect about mindfulness. For me, at least. And it's a story from a Mahayana text called the Lotus Sutra, full of parables and stories. And in there, there's a story of a man who's going to go off traveling back in the ancient times, walking around India or wherever he was going to be, going on a long trip. And while he was sleeping, his friend, who wanted to make sure that he was okay, sewed a very valuable jewel in the lining of his coat. So the man took off, not knowing this, and wandered around for decades, and various adventures, and ended up being quite impoverished, and being quite poor, eventually made it back to his home village or town. And his friend said something like, "But didn't you know about your jewel and in your coat? You're actually a wealthy man. It's just right there, close to you, all the time." And so it's a parable, maybe a silly parable. Well, you know, that why would a friend hide a jewel that he would never find? What good is that? But the parable has to do with the idea we have a jewel. And we can travel around the dusty lands and get impoverished, spiritually impoverished perhaps, not knowing we have this jewel inside. And I think it's a beautiful idea that we already have this jewel, this treasure, as opposed to that we have to spend a lot of time huffing and puffing to prove ourselves or to attain something or to get something. Get the right experience, or get the right wisdom, or get something that we don't have already. But rather this idea, there's already something here, it's in our lining, it's in our veins, in our marrow, it's in our hearts, it's already here, a treasure. And so what is that treasure? And is it something deep and hidden, esoteric, or is it something that's hiding in full view? And so in our tradition, I suggest that what the treasure we're looking for is hiding in full view. In fact, it's the awareness that views, that sees, the mindfulness that can hold things. And mindfulness is often, it's always here, what the Buddha called mindfulness, sati. And it's not a matter of doing mindfulness, as if mindfulness is something you can do, but it's more something that you allow for, or relax into, or open to here. And in fact, the way that mindfulness is discussed by the Buddha was more closer to what we call in kind of modern America, I guess, more like being rather than doing. Some people think about mindfulness as a lot of doing. I have to note this and note this and note this. And there's certainly a doing that's involved with this practice that we do. But the state, the faculty or the state of mindfulness, the faculty capacity for mindfulness, is not so much something we do as something we be. Just like with faith. Faith is not something you do, it's something you have, you cultivate, you can develop, you can strengthen. But it's not something you don't do faith. You have faith, which then supports you. You can do things to cultivate and establish and strengthen energy or effort or strength. But then you have it there to support you and to engage you. So the same thing with mindfulness. It's a faculty. It's a capacity of mind, which can be weak or can be strong. But it's there waiting for us, in a sense. And so in the language of the Buddha, in the teachings of the Buddha, he talked about mindfulness as something we abide in, we dwell in. the again, not so much something we do, an activity, but something we dwell in or abide in. We enter into mindfulness and we abide in it. He told a story. Buddhism is full of parables and similes and stories. And he said that there are places in the mountains, and I guess of India of his time, crags and cliffs, and that are so inaccessible that people can't go there, and monkeys can't go there even. Monkeys who are pretty agile. And then there are places in the wilds, mountains and crags and stuff, that are only accessible to monkeys. People can't go there, just too difficult. And so the monkeys are safe there from people, the hunters. And then there are the flat plains, kind of the more flat areas, which are accessible to both monkeys and people, or most important for the monkeys, to monkey hunters. And if monkeys go down from the mountains enter the places of the, where people are, then they're in danger of being caught. And so he said that there are hunters who will then put out, apparently in ancient India, one way of catching monkeys is to put pitch down on the ground, or in some place. And the monkey would come along, maybe to get some sweet or something, and put a hand in the pitch, and then get kind of stuck. And so then the monkey would take its other hand to help push itself out. And then both hands are stuck. So then the Buddha said they would take its feet, try to push out of the pitch, and then a foot is stuck, and then the other foot. So then both hands and both feet are stuck in the pitch. And then, he said, and then it takes its muzzle to try to force its way out. And then the muzzle gets stuck, this poor monkey, you know. And then the hunter, it's easy for the hunter, I suppose, to come along and pick up the monkey. So then the Buddha went on to kind of explain the parable, and he said that if people leave their domain where they're safe, they also can get caught. They get caught in all kinds of things. They can get caught in papancha, which is the proliferation of thinking, abstract thinking and story-making mind. We get lost in the byways and highways of our stories. And the word papancha means something like, pancha means five, and pa means out. I think of the five things that takes us way out. And so maybe those, like the five ways the monkey is stuck, we get stuck in our papancha, in our thoughts, and our stories, and our evaluations and judgments. And once we put one paw into our papancha, and then we try to get out, by getting involved in it and pushing it away, then pretty soon we put our muzzle in it too. And so there has to be some other trick, to get out, to be free. And so, but what the Buddha said was don't go where it's not safe. Stay in your, and he uses very interesting expression, say, in your ancestral territory. I don't know why he used the word ancestral territory. Stay in your safe domain, in your home territory. And what is your home territory? He said it's the four foundations of mindfulness. If you can stay aware of your body, stay aware of your feelings, stay aware of your mental states, stay aware of your the dharmas, the inner mental truths about how we either get caught or how we get free, that then you're not in the plains, you're not in the territory where you can get caught, get trapped. There's something very protective about mindfulness. So he talked about the importance of contemplating or being attentive to observing your body, being connected to your body, observing and being connected to your feelings, observing and being connected to your mind states, observing and being connected to what's happening with the inner processes that of movements of the mind for and against, the movements of the mind to open up or get caught, to really see this and know these things as they work. And in doing that, being connected to and observing, then mindfulness is established. And here's a very interesting distinction, that there is a practice, the Buddha taught, of knowing what's happening as it's happening. That you can do. And if you focus on trying to know what's happening as you're knowing, understanding what's happening, so if you have knee pain, you can know you have the knee pain. And you can know that you have aversion to the knee pain. And you can know that you're really invested in the aversion, that you're really involved in it. Or you can know that you're angry with yourself because you have aversion. You can know all these things. And if you know them, there's a chance of not being so entangled with it or caught. There's a little bit way in which we separate ourselves from our experience. Separate or free ourselves or make space for our experience when we can know it in a clear way. And by knowing what's happening, observing what's happening, then that is how mindfulness is established. Or that's how a person comes to possess mindfulness. And so the distinction that the Buddha makes, which we don't really make in English when we teach mindfulness, we often teach mindfulness and knowing as being synonymous, as if mindfulness is a thing that we do. But the way the word sati is used in the ancient text, it's not what you do, but it's the result of what you do. It's a state of heightened clarity or clear seeing that comes from practicing understanding or knowing what's happening. Now, you might think it's maybe just semantics or not so important, the distinction between knowing as something that you do and mindfulness as something that you be. But I think that the distinction can be very helpful, because both can go on at the same time. You can do certain things, and also you can be in a certain state. So for example, you can dwell, you can abide in a house. You can say you abide in the house, but then within the house you might be cleaning it or cooking or doing things. You can abide in happiness, but with that happiness you could be talking with a friend or singing a song or doing something, going for a walk. These things can coexist. And so the state of mindfulness, or the quality of mindfulness that the Buddha emphasized, he never used any kind of active verbs to talk about mindfulness, that this is something that you're supposed to do, but he used verbs like endowed with mindfulness, possessed of mindfulness, established in mindfulness, abiding in mindfulness. And if he did talk about cultivating mindfulness or establishing mindfulness, but it wasn't like you were, that doesn't mean that, that's not an activity, that's a result. And you develop this by a variety of things. In the Discourse on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, it gives a variety of ways in which you establish mindfulness. In other places, he talks about other things. As Andrea talked about yesterday, there's a way in which, when you have faith or inspiration or confidence, that gives rise to energy. When you have faith and energy together, that gives rise to a heightened presence, heightened awareness, heightened kind of paying attention to what's here. And you don't have to kind of just there, because you're inspired and you pay attention. Heightened awareness of what's going on around you. The Buddha said that one of the ways to cultivate or to evoke this heightened awareness, heightened clarity, clear seeing, is to live a virtuous life. So if you live ethically virtuous, that's something about that is conducive towards a heightened clarity. Maybe because you're not conflicted or not worried or anxious about getting caught or have regrets and the kind of things that kind of contract or narrow that heightened clarity. In the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, in cultivating mindfulness, the state, the Buddha talked about you observe the body in the body. You observe the feelings and the feelings. You observe mind states and the mind states, and you observe these dharmas. So maybe that's something you can do. You can choose to observe your body in and of itself. And so you could choose a lot of things to place your attention in different places. Right now, some of you are choosing to pay attention to me speaking. So that's partly a choice. And you can choose to pay attention to your thoughts, or particular kinds of thoughts. You can choose to go outside here and look at the sky or the clouds. You can. Oh, one thing we discovered last retreat, when there's a nice kind of blue sky with lots of clouds blowing by, if you sit down in the big room in the bottom, in the big room, and you sit in the chair and you look up in the skylights, it's really a trip. It's quite beautiful. You see these clouds going through the skylights. So you can choose that right now, you know. As opposed to, or you can choose to just, you know, not look up and just look down and do kind of, you know, the more formal mindfulness practice. So there's a lot of things you can choose to do. And so there's something about choosing to observe your body, which is very helpful. The body turns out to be very close it is our lived experience. When you know your body, you're in your lived experience. And the body, people say, is more honest than your mind. There's this expression, the body never lies, because so much of what goes on in our minds gets expressed in our body. It's consciously, subconsciously, in many different ways. And if you tune into your body, there's a tremendous amount of information available of what's going on with you. You can know if you're tense. I've discovered I'm tense or worried only by noticing the contractions in my belly. I didn't know it until I was tuning into my body, and then I said, oh, what's this contraction about? And then I noticed that I was anxious about something or tense about something. And then, you know, our posture, how we stand, how we hold ourselves up, there's a lot of information that's there. If you learn how to observe and be present for your bodily experience, not to make a story about it, but just really feel it and be present for it, it begins to reveal deeper aspects of it all. It's onward leading in a certain way. It leads to greater understanding. So much so that I prefer to restate, I think, the quote by Jung. Rather than dreams being the royal road to the unconscious, it's the body is the royal road to the unconscious. So we choose to pay attention to our body, to notice it. And so I like to think of this practice as a lot to do about becoming embodied. And that goes against the current, or it goes against what many minds are often doing. There can be a very strong tendency to think a lot, to try to solve our problems in our life by thinking or imagining or visualizing, to try to have better pasts by just thinking out better scenarios, better rejoinders to the conversations we had. There can be trying to have better futures by planning and fantasizing about that. There's all kinds of things that goes on. You know, we try to, you know, and it's for good reason. I think that it's difficult to be a human being. There's a lot of challenges, and we need all the help we can get. And one of the places we try to go many times is to into the thinking mind to try to problem solve the situation or reframe it or understand it in some new way. Sometimes it works that way, and it's very meaningful to do it that way. But many times it's not helpful, especially if it's chronic papancha, chronic thinking and story making that we get lost in and thinking about. It turns out a lot of the ways in which we get caught up in self-identity issues. Who am I? Who am I in relationship to other people? What do other people think about me? Am I liked by people? How do I compare to other people? How do I compare to different ideals? Many of the ways in which we suffer around a sense of self belongs to this world of thinking and papancha and making up stories. So it'd be quite meaningful to put that to rest, to shelve it, to say, you know, later, we'll get back to you later, after we have a different reference point to understand who we are or how to be in the world. And so mindfulness is helping us find a different reference point so that maybe it's more realistic or safer for us so we don't get caught in the pitch. So to begin choosing to focus on the body and keep coming back to the body is a way to begin shifting where our attention keeps going, and to begin to let go of the tendency to always be thinking, if that's the case, or be caught in the world of thoughts or imaginings. And every time that you let go of thinking and come back to your body, to the breathing or any part of your body, anything, I believe it diminishes, maybe in a very minuscule way, it diminishes the gravitational force of thinking or the compulsion to think. And you maybe won't see the difference, you know, from one or two or three or 100 times of letting go. But as the Buddha said, with dripping drops of water, the water jug is filled. With dripping drops of water, the bathtub gets filled. It just takes a long time. Slowly, we begin to loosen up and relax the grip that thinking has on us. And the good news, I think, is in my guess, is that you might think that it takes a long time to retrain the mind or let the mind relax. It's not always going so strongly into the world of thoughts. And maybe it does take, in some ways, a long time, but it takes a lot shorter time than the amount of time it took you to get caught up in thoughts. Because that also happens slowly over time. That, because you have the habit of always thinking and always thinking. And if you put together side by side all the moments you've been thinking and having stories next to the amount of time that it takes to let go and come back to the present moment and relax that, it actually goes very fast, that whole process of letting go and coming back. Because, you've been around for a while. So we let go and we come back. We let go and come back. And come back to the body is very useful because the body provides a lot of information. And the more you understand what goes on in the body, the more you probably understand how you react to things, what your feelings are. The body is where you hold a lot of tension and a lot of holding. That as you recognize the tension in your body, there might be a chance to either relax it and thereby relax a little bit in the mind, or not be so, I like the word to soften around it. You can't necessarily relax all your tension, but you can let up a little bit around it, not be so invested in it or so have it so such a powerful force that conditions how you think or how you feel. And the way the Buddha talked about observing the body in the body, he said, body in the body, that's literally the translation. And what it seems to mean is be aware of the body in and of itself. It means a very, very simple being present for your body without adding a story, without adding a judgment, without adding complicated concepts around what's happening in the body, but just to feel it in and of itself. My guess is true for maybe all of you, most of you, that because I think it's true for most people, is that there's usually something about our body that we wish was different. That something is not, is that we're too tall, we're too short, we're too big, we're too this or too that. The hair is not this right color, the eyes, the chin, the nose, the poor nose. And when I was in junior high school, my forehead was too high. I'm very glad to report it's improved since then. There's a tremendous capacity to suffer around our body when we add these stories and comparisons and thoughts as papancha around it. But I can tell you that even though I could had this wonderful capacity to suffer around my forehead, my forehead wasn't suffering. The forehead in and of itself is just a forehead, just there, right? Or when I felt like there are times in my life where I felt my hair was too long, times when I felt it was too short, especially too short, growing up in the hippie days. Just quite, never quite long enough. I used to sit in class pulling it to see if I can get it to have it grow faster. And but my hair was not, you know, unhappy. The hair was just hair, right? So to experience the body in and of itself is the instructions. Just be very simple with it and see if you can free yourself from all the ideations around the body and just feel it in and of itself. This becomes very powerful sometimes with things like pain. Some people find that the simple shift of wording in their minds between saying my pain versus the pain is meaningful for easing up a little bit around the pain. For some people, the seemingly innocent statement, my pain, I hurt so much, is a magnet for self-pity or aversion or all kinds of ideas about what it means to be a self and who I am. We tend to identify or get caught a little bit more easily in pain if it's my pain. And some people find by simply saying the pain that we free ourselves from that strong identification, and pain can just easier to be with, just the pain. I saw this very much when I was a new Zen student, and I had to sit with a lot of knee pain because you weren't allowed to move. And I could see very clearly the pain got worse when I had self-pity. Poor Gil. And then it would hurt so much more. And if I could let go of those thoughts, then it was manageable, just barely. But it, you know, there was this difference, right? So beginning to observe the body in and of itself, it begins to hopefully helps us to let go a little bit, loosen up a little bit by the strong contractions of thinking that we have. The strong ways we're glued to our stories and ideas of what should happen, what we want to happen, our preferences and all this. As we, and this is also very meaningful to do, because one of the ways in which the mind itself is contracted or feels tight or narrow is by being lobbed on or glued on tight to its stories and its preferences and its aversions and caught up in that. And as we begin to let go or soften or relax the preoccupation with thoughts, then awareness gets freed up. Our attention gets freed up. I used to, sometimes I think of the five hindrances as the black holes of the mind. So a black hole, you know, is a kind of a collapsed star. The gravitational force is so strong that any light that gets in its vicinity gets pulled into the star, into the black hole, and never comes out. And so you can't see it because light doesn't come out. So when we can get caught up in desire so intensely, or get caught up in aversion, ill will so intensely, that it becomes a black hole for attention and awareness. And we don't know that, you know, we don't feel that we're there. But as we begin loosening up, letting go, relaxing the pull of our thinking, then awareness gets freed up as well. It's not lost in what we're thinking about. And so then there starts to be a little sense of clarity or openness or relaxation. Or at some point, being aware begins standing out as kind of like a thing in and of itself. As I said this morning, there is what's happening, and then there's how we relate to what's happening. Part of that relating is to be aware of it. And there are times when we are lost in thought, and times when we kind of wake up and we're clear and we're aware that we're aware. I don't know if this is a good example, but it's what occurs to me. I've gone on driving trips, and long trips, and I don't notice the dirt, the dust, the insects, the bugs that kind of begin kind of making up the windshield. And I'm so focused on driving and paying attention that I'm looking past it, not aware that the window is not so clear anymore. And then at some point, the window gets cleaned, and I'm so surprised how clean the window is. I didn't know that, you know, and wow, you know, there's clarity now. And now I become aware of clarity. And clarity stands out. So the same thing with the mind, when the, you know, when all these being caught up in thoughts and everything begins to loosen up, then there start being a sense of clarity, and the clarity it kind of exists there in its own right. What are you clear about? Just whatever you're aware of. So awareness starts standing out, in, standing out a little bit more. And that awareness that stands out, that wider clarity, I believe is what the Buddha referred to as sati, as mindfulness. And then we can abide in that wider clarity. So so you can't just necessarily always kind of just relax and open into a more spacious open clarity or clear seeing or field of awareness. But if we keep coming back to the present moment and seeing what's going on here, it does two things. It helps to free us of the ways that we're caught, and it also strengthens our capacity to observe, strengthens our capacity to be present and see what's happening. As that capacity gets stronger, then at some point you might find that in a relaxed state, relaxed enough, that you can kind of tune into a spacious quality of mind. The Buddha talked about an expanded mind. More recently, people talk about big mind, having a big mind. It kind of gets a little bit trippy to have a sense of awareness that is broader and bigger than the boundaries of your body. Because awareness doesn't have any boundaries. It doesn't have any shape. It doesn't have any color. But everything that we experience happens through the vehicle of awareness, or of presence, or clear seeing, or heightened awareness. One interesting question is, all these people in this room and what's going on here in the room, are those people inside of you or outside of you? Conventionally, certainly it's outside of your skin and outside of the boundaries of your body. In that sense, it's outside. But is it outside of the scope of awareness, the field of awareness? And from that point of view, I think we can say that everything you see happens within the field of your awareness. And that gets a little bit trippy, because then where are you? Who are you? Where's the boundaries? Things feel much more spacious, light, transparent when the awareness kind of opens up and can hold things in a light way, rather than getting fixated on the details or fixated on what we're afraid of or what we want or what we don't like. So we observe what's happening, and observing the body is very helpful. Observing our feelings is very helpful. Observing states of mind is very helpful. Observing what we're doing in our mind, how we're for and against things, is very helpful. And the Buddha kept using this expression, in and of itself, for the mind and the mind, dharmas and the dharmas, feelings and feelings. And I interpret this to be a very compassionate and generous activity of allowing whatever is happening for you to be there. So if you are caught up in thoughts, if you are reactive, that the instructions are not to hit it over the head with a sledgehammer, or to say that to judge yourself as being, oh, now I'm a bad meditator or anything's wrong. It's a very, I think, compassionate or generous to just hold it there and see it clearly for what it is. And the image I have of this kind of the compassionate, generous, caring kind of attention that we're looking for is that of the hands coming together, cupping themselves, forming a little cup, and coming underneath whatever we're knowing, and just knowing it. I'm afraid, just coming underneath the fear and holding the fear. I'm thinking a lot. My mind is thinking about all kinds of fantasy and coming along perhaps and just holding it and feeling it and being present for it. But having enough presence that you're more present, your presence is more powerful and more strong than getting swept up in the fantasy. So you step back in a sense, or there's maybe like there's a strength or power or stability that comes along. It just holds it there, just feels it. So not to push anything away, not to say that something is wrong or bad or you're bad or wrong in any kind of way, but just to observe, to hold there. And then at some point as we do this, then we have the establishment of mindfulness, or we become possessed of mindfulness. Mindfulness becomes something we can abide in, which is this heightened clarity, this clear seeing that is close at hand, so close that sometimes it's not a matter of doing something, it's more a matter of just relaxing or allowing, trusting. We can just trust to be, you know, just to be, have an open state of awareness to what's happening. And then what in that state of open awareness, then when you practice the knowing of what's happening, the doing part of the practice, it's a lot easier to have the knowing be relaxed and generous and non-reactive. And then you can know more carefully. And then it's also easier to experiment with the knowing. So the knowing maybe is more receptive than it is directive. That the knowing is not so much boring into the experience, but it's more allowing the experience to show itself. Because this experience of open clarity, of clear seeing, is very allowing. It allows everything. Open awareness or clear knowing, heightened knowing, in and of itself, does not judge, does not criticize, does not want anything. It's very simple. And in fact, my own practice, I like to consider mindfulness and simplicity as near cousins, or almost synonyms of each other. Because if it's not simple, I don't think it's mindfulness. Because mindfulness is a very simple state of open awareness that we come to and we get a sense of and we can abide in. And then it seems that in the teachings of the Buddha that he indicated that when we can abide in this state of mindfulness, the state of sati, that then it's kind of like a, not kind of, a, then it's like a river that flows downhill. He said, just as the Ganges River flows gradually down as it flows east, and eventually reaches the ocean, so when we have established mindfulness, we gradually flow down to reach freedom, to liberation, to Nibbana. So rather than the goal of liberation, which is kind of the goal of practice, being something that you have to do, it's more something that you get carried along in if you've discovered this wonderful treasure, this jewel of this open awareness, this relaxed, spacious presence of what's here. It seems, this is called the ancestral territory, the home domain, this kind of awareness and this kind of presence. It's a place to abide in. I like to think of it just a place to be home. And so, a little bit like the discussion I had the other day about faith, I said, you know, what do you have faith in? And maybe it's useful to look at the things that you have faith in. And maybe it's not the best place to put your trust. Same thing with where's your home? Where do you take up residency? If you take up residency in your anxiety, that has one result. If you take up residency in simplicity or in open awareness, that has a different result. So where do you tend to reside? Where do you tend to live? Do you live in thinking? Do you live in fantasy? Do you live in judgment? Do you live in harshness? Do you live in in discouragement, or do you live in confusion? Do you live in, you know, where do you tend to live your life? And is it time to move? Get a new house? Get a new home? Or say it differently, maybe it's time to come home from those other residences. Those are not your home, your real home. Come home. Come home. And that could be maybe like almost like a little mantra as you stay here, just do this practice here. Say to yourself, come home. Come home. Come here. Come home to yourself. If you're thinking about the future, thinking about the past, you're not home. Home is here and now. Home is in your lived experience now. Home is something very simple. Home perhaps can be found in the open, relaxed awareness of what's happening as it's happening. Everything that's happening is allowed to happen. That's the generous part of this practice. But we're not so invested in it or caught in it. We're not living in it. There can still be fear, but we don't live in the fear. We live in the awareness of the fear. And there's a world of difference. I don't live in my pain. I live in awareness of the pain. So come home. Come home. And if that's a meaningful mantra as you stay here, come home. You might use it. Come home. Come back home. Here. So the way the practice of mindfulness is taught, it's taught often with emphasis on knowing what's happening as it's happening. In the Discourse on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, it begins with focusing on the breath, and then before you start doing a lot of knowing, relax the bodily formations, relax your body. Be with your breath and relax a little bit, kind of preliminary when you begin. And then with that as a foundation, some modicum of relaxation, then we practice this knowing of what's happening. So because it's, so some people then will say that's what mindfulness is. That's what mindfulness practice is. It's the practice that leads to the establishing or the strengthening or the evoking of sati, of a state or quality of mindfulness, which is this open, I like to think of it as clear awareness, clear seeing, open awareness, that is your treasure, that's is sewed into the lining of your coat. All you gotta do is to take off your coat, take off your, what your, this heavy thing you're carrying around, and you'll find it there. It's a beautiful process to come into mindfulness, to come home. And on retreats like this, one of the things that supports this a lot is doing the practice. The practice works if you do it. And if you don't do it, it doesn't work. And so what that means in terms of being on retreat, it actually helps a lot to try to give yourself over to doing the mindfulness, to do the knowing practice, being present, observing, coming home, being here, as continuously as you can throughout the day. Not in a forceful way, and certainly not in a way that makes you tense or exhausted, but can you give yourself over more now that we're into the, we're kind of really in the retreat now? Can you give yourself over more to give yourself the care and the slowness and the sensitivity and the to really kind of stay close to yourself, stay close at home, stay in the field of awareness, stay connected, slowed, maybe slowing down enough or being attentive enough that you could say, it's kind of like, be mindful of what's happening as it's happening so that you know that you know. Not that you're always going around knowing that you know, but you kind of your mindfulness, your awareness, your presence, your understanding of what's happening as it's happening is strong enough that you know that you know. And if you're at that level, then if you can keep that going as much as possible, you'll probably start seeing that your mindfulness will grow and develop. So sometimes there's a custom on these retreats to not take questions at the end of a talk, but rather to regather after the talk. So we'll sit for a couple of minutes, sit quietly and gather yourself together. Come home to yourself.